We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. To date, most of the conversation about climate change has really concentrated on energy and the feeling that a lot of people have that we need to change the way that we produce energy and the way that we use it. Well, in this part of the show, we will be talking about an aspect of global climate that has, in recent years, particularly in the last couple of years, really begun to get more and more attention. And that is the connection between climate and what we eat, the food on our plates. And our guest for the program this morning is Anna Lappe. She is the author of a couple of books, including the most recent, that lays out some ideas that we'll talk about this morning. The book that she titles Diet for a Hot Planet. The subtitle is The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And the book has been out just short of a year, came out last March. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She is well known for speaking and writing about things like sustainability and food politics and globalization. She is a founding principal with her mother, Frances Moore Lappe, of the Small Planet Institute, which is a network for research and popular education about the root causes of hunger and poverty. They're also co-founders of the Small Planet Fund, which has raised and given away a significant amount of money to social movements around the world, two of them that have actually won the Nobel Peace Prize since it was set up in 2002. That is the fund since it was set up. She does a lot of interviews. She's appeared often on television, done a lot of speaking. In addition to her book, Diet for a Hot Planet, she's also written Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. That was 2002. And then Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen. That was published in 2006. And her writing has appeared in a lot of other places. She's here visiting in our area as a guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. Now, she's already been here a couple of days, and there have been some events, and they'll be doing some. She'll be doing some other kind of talks. Everything that they do there, the programs, are open to the public. And if you'd like to find out more about what she'll be doing, probably the easiest thing to do is open up your browser and just Google Unit 1. And then you can find the website for Allen Hall, and you can find out more about her schedule if you might like to hear more from her. But, of course, if you're interested in reading Diet for a Hot Planet or her other books, you can go to the bookstore, you can go to the library, and you can look for the books. And here on the program, questions are welcome as we talk, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And emails are welcome, too. You want to do that? Will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. That is the address. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
This just to start out, I guess, and this is something that I know that you talk a lot about when you talk about Diet for a Hot Planet and these ideas, is how it is that you get to thinking about food, given that for people who are concerned about climate change, the big thing always has been energy, use of fossil fuels, how we generate electricity, how we get around. That's the big thing. But really, it wasn't until a couple of years ago, and at the point where you started doing the work that results in this book, that I think people really started looking seriously about the food system that produces our food and what sort of impact that has on global climate. Why is it that that took such a long time?
Well, that is the question, right? I mean, I think a couple things were happening at once a few years ago. First of all, I think we certainly were reaching this point where global scientific consensus about the climate crisis was really coalescing around sentiment that this is really serious. We really have to take serious action and that every sector needs to play its part. We can't just narrowly look at, you know, one particular sector. And the other thing that was happening at the same time that that conversation was really coalescing globally is that then kind of forced people to broaden their perspective and to say, okay, well, let's really look broadly at all the different factors factors that are driving global greenhouse gas emissions. Let's look at all the greenhouse gases, not just carbon dioxide, even though that's the lion's share of greenhouse gases. Let's look at methane. Let's look at nitrous oxide. Let's look at all the key greenhouse gases. And when you kind of open your perspective in that way, what happens is that food, farming, agriculture kind of jumps directly into the picture. And that's what personally happened to me in about 2006 when I started connecting these dots. You know, I've been thinking and caring a lot about food and food systems, and it really wasn't until 2006 when I started reading some of the new research that was coming out that was connecting these dots that I also kind of had my wake-up moment and said, wait a second, if we care about the climate, we also have to talk about food and farming.
Yeah. Well, and for you, it seems that maybe not surprising, that a major focus is the way that we now produce meat for human consumption. Partly it's this issue that you argue, and this actually goes back to the argument that your mom made in 1971 when she wrote Diet for a Small Planet, when she said, you know, to raise plant material to feed animals so we can eat the animals doesn't make a whole lot of sense. As I say, that's really not real efficient. Better that we get the animals out of there. But it's not simply that, but it's also the move that we have made to raising animals on a very large scale. So big numbers of animals and concentrated in large production facilities and the contribution that those animals make to global warming.
That's right. And obviously the title of my new book, Diet for a Hot Planet, was kind of a very obvious connection to my mother's work. Her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, essentially, you very nicely just summarized the message. And essentially what I'm talking about now, what sort of many of us in the food movement are talking about now, is that there is this other hidden cost to the choices that we've made about how we produce food, where we produce it, what animals we're raising, how we're raising them. And that hidden cost is this cost to the climate. And in 2006, one of the formative moments for me in this work was reading a report from the United Nations. That was the first time researchers really tried to do a comprehensive analysis of all of the greenhouse gases that can be directly tied back to livestock production. And what they found in that report is about 18% of global greenhouse gases at that time in 2006 could really be estimated to be tied back to the livestock sector. That report was called Livestock's Long Shadow. Although I like to say, let's not blame the cows. It's not, you know, it's not these animals' fault themselves. It's actually, you know, these very specific human decisions and human policies and human priorities that have been pushing us in, as you described it, this very irrational direction where, as my mother estimated in her book in the early 70s, we're using about 16 pounds of grain and soy to produce 1 pound of beef at the end of the day, not to mention the water that gets used up, the chemicals, the nitrogen-based fertilizers. So it's an irrational system that's been allowed to spread globally that is heavily fossil fuel-based, fossil fuel-dependent, and that it's not the whole story of the food and climate connection, but it's a big piece of it.
Well, and also a point that's worth making, and you do make, when you have to acknowledge that what we have now is a global food system. It's globalized to the extent that we eat food now that is grown and processed all over the world, and the simple cost and whatever much greenhouse gas is produced just by moving all that stuff around is really considerable. And it's I'm sure you can come up easily with examples that show that to a crazy degree.
Right. And you have one of my favorite examples of just the complete irrationality of this industrialized food system that people often are told is, you know, the most efficient way to be producing food. Well, you know, I sort of ask myself, is it really efficient that now we have we've moved the factory farms not just to cattle and to pork to chickens, but we've also now moved it to fish. So we're factory farm raised fish where you, again, just like cattle, it takes 6, 7, 10 pounds or more of feeder fish to give us 1 pound of some of the larger fish that we eat. And you have a kind of situation where it's not uncommon for feeder fish to be raised in far, far south in Chile to then be shipped to the Northwest Northwest, where they're fed to salmon in factory farms in the Northwest. And then because of the way that salmon grow, the kinds of bones salmon have, it's very labor intensive to debone that salmon. And it makes kind of economic sense then to ship that salmon from the Northwest to China, where it gets deboned and then shipped back to the Northwest and then shipped out throughout the United States. I mean, that to me is, on its face, completely irrational. Why would we do that? Well, we do that in a system that doesn't embed the true costs of food doesn't embed the true cost of food and sort of put it on the shoulders of the companies that are making these decisions about how we raise our food. A sort of footnote to that story, though, is that as we think about the food and climate connection, I always like to stress the idea that most people have, I think, if they've thought at all about this, is that, oh, the reason why there's a food and climate connection is because of all those transportation emissions associated with all this hauling of food all around the planet. Actually, on average in the U.S., one study I saw estimated that just 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the average food in the U.S. comes from transport emissions, that it's actually not the most significant piece of the connection, that actually these other choices that are made about production, as in, you know, were chemical pesticides used? Was fossil fuel-based synthetic nitrogen fertilizer used? Was it a factory farm intensive system? Those things actually really add into the story in addition to that transport.
Yeah. Well, you know, sorry to keep talking about your mom. you know, one of the things that she wrote about in Diet for a Small Planet back in 1971 that maybe at the time seemed striking. I don't know if it's seems quite so striking anymore. But one of the things that she wrote was, when you're talking about hunger on a global scale, this is not a supply problem. The earth is capable of producing enough food to feed everybody. It's not about supply. It's about food policy. Having said that, though, I'm sure that people who represent big food producing, processing, and distributing businesses, that industry, say, well, you know, we're feeding the world, though, and that they would say something like, the system that we have is necessary to making that possible. And they'd say, and I'm sure with some sincerity, that that's their goal. They're in business. Their goal is to make money. But that they would say, well, our goal is to feed the world, and that's what we're doing. And if you want to push us into doing something really different, then that's going to jeopardize our ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that you have just described the myth that my mother has been combating for, as we said, 40 years, four decades. And as I was doing the research for this book, I mean, it's that same really powerful message that we still hear today from the food industry. And I have a number of examples in the book of you know, headlines of articles in major mainstream newspapers repeating that storyline, right? And I was really curious myself to sort of say, okay, well, let's really look at the data again. You know, 40 years on, let's look at what is it that we know about food production on the planet today? Actually, maybe have we reached a place where we truly do have a scarcity of food? And what we see today, just as we did 40 years ago when my mother started doing this work, is that we still produce more than enough calories as a planet to feed the entire planet, not only to get everybody the calories that they need to survive, but actually to make us all chubby. And yet we exist on a planet that is in this paradoxical moment where we see about 1.2 billion people who are underfed, many who are chronically hungry. And at the same time, we have 1.2 billion people who are overfed, getting malnourished in a sense with calories that are calories that they don't need and aren't really contributing to their health. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this myth, though, it's so powerful, because who among us would want to feel like something that we're fighting for or something that we believe in would lead to hunger in the world, right? None of us would want to think that we were promoting a policy that would end up creating hunger in the world. And so a big section in the book that I end up ended up writing was kind of exploring that myth again, saying there is this kind of scaremongering that's happening that says that if we were to move toward organic agriculture, if we were to get ourselves off of this fossil fuel dependent form of food and farming, we would be committing a good chunk of the world to hunger. And what I say is that we now have, even more so than when my mother was doing this work 40 years ago, we now have incredible data coming out from some of the most poverty-stricken, hunger-stricken regions of the world that are showing us that actually moving away from expensive, fossil fuel-intensive, chemical-dependent farming toward really knowledge-intensive farming based on ecological practices not only saves those farmers money, not only releases them and sort of liberates them from having to buy seeds from half a world away and buy chemicals from half a world away, but it also increases yields and promotes food security. And we have that data confirming that over and over and over again in countries all around the world that are often held up as kind of the poster children for where there's hunger on the planet.
Well, let me follow up to that and ask something that's related, because I also it is also the case that at least here in the United States, food is really cheap. And if you look at the percentage of their income that Americans spend on food, that it's quite low. And compared to other countries, it's really low. There are a lot of places where people are spending a lot more of their money on food. And I'm sure that also there were people who would say that that the kind of changes maybe that you would advocate for and that you would be talking about, those things would be really nice, but it's going to drive up the cost of food. It's going to make it more expensive.
Well, I think that is a really serious question that I definitely don't take lightly or take flippantly and say, oh, well, you know, too bad for them. They're just going to have to figure out a way to pay more for food, right? That's certainly not how I think we should respond to that question. What I emphasize instead is that, you know, I say, look, if you look at how much of our tax dollars are going toward food programs and farm programs in this country, the answer is hundreds of billions of dollars. And if you look at what we're incentivizing with those tax dollars, what we're investing in, what we're helping to promote in terms of food infrastructure and farming programs and farming knowledge, what you'd see is that most of that money is going to just a handful of commodity crops that are going to those factory farms or that are going to things like high fructose corn syrup, which I don't think anybody would put on a list of, you know, the healthiest thing you could consume. And the lion's share of that is also going to research on not these ecological practices, but these really climate-intensive ones. Less than 4% of our agricultural research dollars goes toward exploring ways to get ourselves off of fossil fuels in the food system. So I would say, you know, we're not going to kind of turn the system around without investment. And I think once you start actually changing what we are investing in as a nation, you start shifting what we're producing, and it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you and I as food consumers have to pay that price. It's similar to the public conversation we're having. There's a clear analogy to the public conversation we're having about transforming our energy sector or transforming our transportation sector. I mean, I don't think any one of us as individuals should have to pay to as individual consumers to pay to put the high-speed rails in, that we're saying as a country, this should be a national project. And I think similarly, we need to have that frame of mind that sees transforming our food toward climate-friendly food as a national project on the scale of getting us onto solar energy and getting us onto public transportation.
Let me reintroduce again our guest for this hour, Anna Lepe. She is an author, public speaker, does a lot of work on the area of sustainability, food politics, globalization. She's authored a number of books. Her most recent is Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. That book just came out a year ago in March, Bloomsbury, is that right? Mm-hmm. Is the publisher. And it takes a look at the connections between the systems we have for producing food globally and global warming. And so if you're interested, you take a look at it. She is the founding principal, along with her mom, Frances Moore Lepe, of the Small Planet Institute, also co-founders of the Small Planet Fund. She does a lot of speaking on this very subject. She's here in Champaign-Urbana visiting the campus as a guest in residence at Unit 1 at Allen Hall, and we'll be here for a couple of days and more. So again, if you'd like to hear about some of the talks that she's going to be giving, they are open to the public. Go to the Allen Hall website. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. This station, we've been here for a long time, and a lot of our time is spent talking to farmers, doing agricultural news. And these are the people who a lot of them produce corn and beans. When they hear people like you, they take that as something of a criticism of who they are and what they do. And I'm sure that they want to say things like, you know, I care about the environment. I care about this land that I'm farming here. I'd like to be able to pass that on to my children so that they can also farm. I want to be a responsible steward. I also have to make a living. And that I'm trying to use the best technology that I can, the best science, the most common sense approach to do all of that. And I'm sure that they might say, well, what do you want? What do you want from me? What do you want me to do, or how would you want me to do things differently than I'm doing them now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great question, and I think I guess I'd begin by saying that the people who have most inspired me in this work have been the farmers that I've met, who are really kind of at the front lines of feeding us. Mm-hmm. And some of the most moving conversations I've had with farmers have been with the farmers who one might think of as kind of your stereotypical image of the American farmer growing the commodity crops. One of them was this farmer I met in Missouri who had about 10,000 acres of genetically modified row crops. And we were having this conversation in his kitchen at his on his farm. And what he was telling me is that he was one of the things that he did along with being a farmer is that he was an activist working on trying to bring back competitiveness into the American food system, and that he was very critical of genetically modified foods, that he was very critical of the Farm Bill and commodity supports, the particular kinds of commodity supports that we had in the system, and that he was fighting it in his kind of off hours when he wasn't farming. And I very gently said to him, but wait, this seems like a contradiction, but you're also growing Monsanto products. I don't quite get it. And he said, well, Anna, you know, a lot of people don't sort of feel comfortable talking about this, but you know, I just want to share with you what a lot of people don't understand, who themselves aren't farmers or don't come from farm families, is that, you know, I do this work because I want to have this kind of life for myself, my family, my kids. I want to be a farmer. And at this point in time, in this state, in this country, it is impossible for me to farm any other way because there has become such a monopoly on what seeds are available, what chemicals are available, who controls policymaking in this country, what kinds of incentives there are, what kinds of supports I can get as a farmer. And so I am going to farm the only way that I can at the moment. And at the same time, I'm going to be advocating for fundamental change that would make it possible for my kids to farm in a different way. And so I think that conversation, along with many others, was a really great example for me about how, you know, we're all in this together. I mean, there are a lot of farmers who would want to make different choices but can't, just like there are a lot of consumers who don't want to go to McDonald's for every meal, who don't want to serve their kids food that's filled with high fructose corn syrup and trans fats and all kinds of things, and yet don't have the choice because of the monopolies that we have in our food system. And so I think that it's not saying putting the blame on any one of us individuals, but saying that real change is only going to come as we actually advocate for collective change to happen.
So you would make the argument that it's possible for somebody who is involved in farming to do things in a different way, to produce a good product, maybe you would say, as far as the environment was concerned, a better product at an affordable price. We can afford the food, they can make a living, that it's actually possible. You would say, oh, yeah, it's possible to do all that.
It's certainly possible. I mean, we could also look at policies in other countries. I mean, there are other not everyone does it the way we do it, right? And, you know, there's that great example that got a lot of coverage recently of looking at a factory farm system in Denmark. So even if we weren't to end factory farming in this country, if you look at what other countries have done in terms of eliminating certain chemicals that are now prohibited or antibiotics that are prohibited in Denmark, it didn't make factory farming more expensive, but it meant it was a lot more safe for public health reasons. And similarly, there's a lot of things that we can do that would make even a current conventional system more rational and more effective. Like at the moment, one of the major sources of agricultural nitrous oxide emissions is our fertilizer use, and especially in this country. The typical farmer using synthetic fertilizer uses about twice as much as the crop can actually, corn, for instance, can actually uptake. So we're wasting a lot of nitrogen fertilizer. So even if we weren't to eradicate row crop corn farming that's going to factory farms, to just do that more efficiently and use nitrogen fertilizer more effectively, that could make a difference.
About our midpoint here, we have a number of callers. We'll try to get everybody. Folks will help us by being as brief as they can, just to share the space with other people who are listening. But we'll try to talk with as many callers as possible. And we have the lines full right at the moment. So we'll start out with first in line, someone in LaSalle County on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. I have firsthand knowledge of the impact of the chemical farming. My family owns a farm in Sheridan, Illinois, where they have a sand pit. When I was a child, there were fairy shrimp and snails, and mayflies by the millions would fly over. They're all gone. The only time you can find a snail shell is in, if you're snorkeling, is in a bass bed. And these animals, and the leopard frogs and the green frogs are gone. All that are left are the bullfrogs. This is the impact. They had a pump handle in the town of Sheridan, Illinois. When I was a little kid, we would get drinks of water from that pump. They took the pump handle off because the water is dangerous. And I asked my father when I was like 14 or 15, why did they take the handle away? Well, the water, you can't drink the water anymore. And this water table was 30 or 40 feet below the surface, which is where the sand pit is, and the impact is terrible. And in the name of ethanol, this is the holy grail in the Midwest. Not one senator, not one congressman can get elected if he's against ethanol, he or she. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world. They get 98% of the chemical energy goes into get ethanol. And now, thank you very much.
All right. Well,
thank you for that comment. And it just reminds me of pretty much every time I have ever interviewed a farmer about for this book and my other work, I have heard heartbreaking stories of either themselves or someone in their family or an aunt or an uncle who has had cancer, who's had some kind of illness that they have assumed was connected to the pesticides used on the farm. There was we're sort of in the midst of the largest agricultural health study of farmers and farm workers in this country, looking at, you know, are there different rates of cancers for those workers? And the answer coming out of that data is that yes, there is. And I think one of one of the most exciting things about talking about food and climate, about talking about how do we farm differently that's good for the environment, that's good for the climate, that's healthy for farmers and farm workers, is that we can actually turn this around and turn it around pretty quickly. One of the farmers that I met and I talk about in the book is a farmer in Wisconsin who took over dozens and dozens of acres of farmland in the heart of Wisconsin. It used to be just chemical row crop corn. And he took it over about 13 years before I went to visit him. And standing on his farm, you could still see these row crops off in the distance, these kind of just absolute monochrome farmland. And standing on his land where he had hundreds of varieties of crops that he was growing, perennials and annuals and shrubs and all kinds of fruits and vegetables and nuts and berries. And you could hear, I mean, it was like almost you had to almost cover your ears, you know, the sound of the insects and the birds. And he was talking about the abundance of microorganisms that had come back. And it was just after that really, really big flood a couple years ago in the Midwest. And I was asking him, you know, were you devastated like all the farmers that I've been hearing about in this region? And he said, actually, my farm has never been better. That because his soil had been so cared for with these ecological practices, that it acted as a sponge that retained that water and it didn't create the devastating gullies that affected the other farms. And that he also said, what he saw for the first time after that flood and the pocket ponds that were created after that flooding is he said he started to see the frogs, that they had come back to the land. So I think that bringing food into the conversation about climate is, to me, one way to bring some hope into the story about climate change, that we can see the way that these ecological practices can really rehabilitate the land and bring in that biodiversity that's so essential.
Another caller, Joliet, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I've got a comment about our mass production. And when problems arise, such as the recall of the tomatoes and the peanuts and meat, where you throw away millions and millions of pounds of our production, what impact does that have on our society? When I hear about this, where they have some bad meat, it's got salmonella or some nasty bacteria, and all of a sudden we say, throw it away. I'll stop there and I'll wait for your comment.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, that is a fabulous question, because when we look at the myths, going back to kind of what are the myths we hear, one of the stories we hear about our food system is that it is so efficient, that we're producing this food so efficiently. What is hidden in that myth is that actually the U.S. food system wastes between 30 to 50% of food that we could be eating gets wasted. It gets wasted either on the farm, it gets plowed under when, say, the price for lettuce drops and the farmer decides they don't want to sell it, they'll just plow it under. It gets wasted at the restaurant level, it gets wasted at the household level, it gets wasted in the distribution process, it gets wasted on the shelves of supermarkets when it doesn't get sold. So there's all that waste, all that energy that went into producing that food that then gets wasted. But the other part of that question that I think is such an important point is that, you know, pretty much since the advent of agriculture 12,000, 13,000 years ago, we knew that there is safety in diversity. That food security comes from having a variety of foods that we're growing, a variety of foods that we're eating. And to me, this is actually one of the strongest cases to be made against genetically modified foods, about saying, you know, is it safe for us to have one kind of corn being raised in the U.S.? Is that really the direction we want to go? We're now hearing from the biotech industry that we will have genetically modified foods that will help us deal with the droughts that will be imminent with the climate crisis, or help us deal with the floods that we're going to see more of. But my question to myself, to all of us, is do we really want to be relying on one kind of seed, you know, setting aside all the debates that we might have about will that seed actually perform in the way that's being promised? To me, I think the answer is already really clear that no, absolutely not. We don't want to be dependent on any one crop, on any one seed varietal, that we need diversity. And it's that diversity that you see on every single organic farm that's really using ecological practices.
We have now about 15 minutes left. And again, we have some other callers and I want to try to get on to. Our guest is Anna Lappe. Her most recent book is Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. It takes a look at the relationship between the system of food production that we have and global climate issues. That is something that she has been thinking about, writing about, and talking about for some time. She does a lot of speaking and writing on the issues of sustainability and food politics. She is the founding principal, along with her mom, Frances Moore Lappe, of the Small Planet Institute. They're also co-founders of the Small Planet Fund. She's here visiting on the campus. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-9455. 800-222-9455. Let me, I have some other callers here. Let me just ask you a question that comes in by email that's kind of interesting. I think I might know what you would say, but we have somebody here who wants to know what you'd think of the possibility of insect farming as a more environmentally friendly protein source.
That's definitely the first I've gotten of that question. And I don't know much about insect farming as a possible protein source. I mean, I think that, I guess one thing that comes up when I hear that question is I always like to remind us that there is, I think, and we could sort of debate about where this comes from, but there is in this country this real fascination and focus on protein and the need to get, we need to get so much protein. How are we going to get our protein? When if you look at how much protein we consume in this country on average, the average American is consuming about twice as much protein as our bodies can even use. So that's actually kind of another form of food waste. I mean, our bodies can't retain that protein, so we just excrete it out. We're not storing it and using it for later, right? So as protein. So we're actually, in this overconsumption of protein, we're overproducing protein. And so, to me, I'm not as fixated on how are we going to have this access to the protein we need. We're producing more than enough. And yes, in terms of the point about biodiversity, I think we also can be looking at diverse sources of protein. And as my mother's been saying for 40 years, those diverse sources of protein don't always they don't always have to be animal-based, insect or otherwise.
Okay. Well, it is kind of an interesting question. I guess what it goes to is the fact that if you look around the world, there are people who eat everything that it is possible
for
a human being to eat. And there are certainly a lot of places where people eat insects because that's what's there. To us, that, of course, sounds strange and creepy. But if that's the way you were raised, well, that's not going to seem so odd. And I think that there are actually people who are raising that as a reasonable question. Well, there are people who use that for a food source. Why not?
That's right. And there's kind of this new movement of chefs who are really trying to get Americans to get out of this really kind of myopic consumption of only certain meat products are acceptable for us. Only certain, body parts of the animal are acceptable for us to eat. And I certainly am no meat aficionado. I don't eat it myself, but talking to these chefs, one of their campaigns is that we need to kind of, again, diversify what we're consuming. For those of us who are going to be consuming animal protein and consuming livestock, we should be using the whole animal, and we should be bringing back these cuts of meat that have been kind of poo-pooed. We should be bringing back these parts of the animal that are perfectly fine and safe to eat, but have been, for whatever reason, considered, off the plate.
Yeah. Well, just real quick, you're a vegetarian. Diet for a small planet.
Well, I shouldn't say vegetarian because I do eat sustainable raised fish.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, you're a piscivore. and I think diet for a small planet, I think, is essentially based on the idea that if you're going to eat meat, not too much, and maybe it'd be better if you didn't eat any meat at all. For those people who are not, I eat meat I'm not ready tomorrow to give it up completely, but I think that there are a lot of people who understand that maybe it would be good if they made an effort to just eat less.
Mm-hmm.
So what has anybody looked at a question like this? Well, supposing that people who do eat meat instead of just completely giving it up, they reduce their meat consumption by, something significant, like 25%, which seems reasonable.
Right.
What that would mean if everybody in the United States who ate meat just said, I'll reduce it by a quarter. I'll have that much less.
Right. Well, there's been really, unfortunately, what you find when you start doing this research is that there aren't the kinds of studies that I would like to see out there. Mm-hmm. And that's partly, again, goes back to where we're putting our research dollars. But there was one study done a number of years ago out of the University of Chicago that looked at this question and looked at what's the global warming impact of a vegan diet, a vegetarian diet, and a typical American kind of meat diet. And their kind of quippy conclusion is that the difference between a typical American diet of meat consumption versus a vegan diet is kind of the carbon equivalent of driving an SUV versus driving a Prius, that it really does have this difference. And they, in that study, they had some estimate of, you know, if this number of Americans really were to cut back, even not becoming vegan, but as you said, even just a small percentage, 1 or 2 days a week cutting out meat, it would be the equivalent of taking tens of millions of cars off the road. And unfortunately, there haven't been more studies done, and those numbers were just estimates. I mean, when you start aggregating out to that level, you really have to just sort of be guesstimating there. But I think the conclusion to me from it is that absolutely, if we really were to shift what we're producing in this country, what we're consuming, that there is this big impact. And that's why I'm so passionate about this work and about this story. But I think what I also like to emphasize is that, again, it's not going to come from just the choices that you and I make about what we eat, that we need to be engaged as citizens in this conversation about where our priorities are as a nation, in the same way that we're starting to get that and get sort of fired up about that when it comes to energy policy, when it comes to transportation policy, that kind of fiery passion I'd love to see there in terms of food policy.
Yeah. Well, and I think, though that in terms of your recommendations for what if people said, OK, well, I'm interested in trying to address this in my life, the sort of things you would say to do. What interests me is that they're the kind of things that I think people actually are already doing, things like trying to buy your food from somebody who grows it locally.
That's exactly right.
Favoring organic producers, trying to eat more vegetables, which is good for you anyway.
That's right.
Don't try not to waste.
That's right.
Food. Those sorts of things.
That's exactly right. So that to me is, again, sort of one of the positive upshots of this research is that if you do want to embrace a climate-friendly food system, if you want to have your diet have less of an impact on the climate, those choices, as you just enumerated them, they're the same ones that are good for your local and regional economy. They're good for your neighbors. They're good for your body. They're good for your kids. They're good for water quality in your region. They're good for, you know, all these other things. And there are things like, you know, choosing organic products as much as you can. They're choosing regional foods. If you're eating meat, eat less of it, but also choosing pasture-raised cattle. Those kinds of things can make a difference, wasting less. And they're also actually, despite the myths you might hear otherwise, they can actually be more affordable choices as well.
All right. We have a number of callers here. We have now about 7-8 minutes. We'll try to get as many as we can. Geneva or Elburn is next, line number 2. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I like this topic. This is great. I worry about all the pesticides we're putting in the ground, especially out here where you're drilling, you know, you pull your water out of the ground. All these people who put on the chemicals on their grass to kill the dandelions and whatnot, all those chemicals are going through the grass and into the ground and into the water system. I know we do have, proper water system, but still, I mean, we hear all these scary things about drugs being being into water system and all this other stuff. I mean, this is just another point. We got to do something better. I mean, I disagree with it. I won't put anything on my grass, but I grow my own vegetables. I try not to put any chemicals on it, although the last couple of years, because I didn't put any Miracle-Gro stuff on there, I'm getting a lot of those tomato worms. But, you know, people have to be smarter. Farmers have to be smarter with what they are. And the only thing is there's a fine line between, like, for instance, the locusts getting into some of this stuff. And, you know, some of the bugs, you got to do something in some cases to prevent them. Now, I heard a gentleman call back and say earlier that, you know, what about bugs? Why we, you know, do some other things? It's kind of, again, you're going a fine line. Like farm fishing. You know, a lot of people are doing a lot of salmon farm fishing now instead of out in the wild, which makes sense, but then all the stuff they feed the fish seem to have a problem. I'm just curious on what you say about that, and I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we, again, to kind of put our American story into the global context, I really, the more you look into what other countries, choices other countries, especially in Europe, have made about chemical pesticides on farmland, you realize that we kind of are guinea pigs of this a food production system that's really based on the use of pesticides, many of which are probable carcinogens, endocrine disruptors, or neurotoxins. And although we have on the books and federal law regulations for chemicals regulated by the EPA, about 89,000 chemicals are currently in production, many of them were grandfathered in when our regulations on pesticide controls and chemical controls came in into place in the early 70s. And so many of those pesticides had never even really been tested. And so there is kind of a new movement that I'm optimistic about that's really trying to put pressure on the federal government to really be much more strict about what chemicals are used on farmland, what chemicals are used to grow our food. And especially when we have this data that's been coming out in the past couple of years that shows how much, especially infants and children, are affected by consuming food that's been raised with toxic pesticides.
Yeah. And just one other thing, I think that it is a fair point that, and I'm sure that some farmers would want to make it, that use of chemicals in agriculture, that's not the only source of chemicals in water.
That's absolutely right.
Chemicals that put on the home landscape, on golf courses.
Golf courses.
That is an issue.
That's right. That's right. No, golf courses and lawns, are a huge, huge source of chemicals on land in this country. Absolutely.
All right. Let's go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I wonder, are you familiar with the Yearbook of Agriculture?
Yes.
In the late 1970s, I think it was 1980, actually, Secretary Freeman put out a yearbook which was devoted to efficiency in agriculture and came up with some rather astonishing figures. For instance, it was found that the optimal efficiency for a vegetable farm in California was about 35 acres, and that a family farmer with just family labor and his own and smaller equipment could produce food more efficiently and also produce a very good income for his family on that 35-acre farm. In the Midwest at that time, optimal efficiency was reached at about 250 acres, and it didn't drop rapidly thereafter. So a 1,000-acre farm or so was still quite efficient. But the profitability of particularly vegetable farming in California was not on efficiency for the large operators, but on suppressing wages. There's quite a bit of other information in the book that I think you would find interesting, if you can find a copy. When the Reagan administration took office, they took it off the market and destroyed all remaining copies that had not been sold. But I think you'd find it very interesting.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think, to me, I have to say, doing this work, and it's very much work that is part, as we've been discussing today, part of the lineage of my mother. And also my father was a medical ethicist and epidemiologist, and late in his life did a lot of work on looking sort of from a scientific perspective at genetically modified foods and really kind of looking at what are the yield outcomes from these genetically modified foods. He did a lot of work on toxic chemicals and pesticides. And so this work is very much in the lineage of my parents' work that have been doing this work for decades. And I guess what's being so striking to me in this call as a reminder of it as well is that so much of what we're saying today, we've known this for years. We're saying the same thing, and yet we're still fighting these really powerful myths and this really powerful messaging machine that's funded by tens of millions of dollars from just the handful of companies that currently control most of the food. You see in the supermarket is controlled by just a handful of companies that are really powerful in terms of the messages that we hear about what is efficient and how we should farm. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like all of us, whether we kind of think of ourselves as media makers or not, are really, are really part of changing the story of what would healthy food look like? What would affordable food look like? What would an efficient food system look like? What would a climate-friendly food system look like? So I kind of implore all of us to be media makers.
Yeah. I want to get in. We don't have time to get in all the callers we have. I wanted to do an email here, and I'm going to bite the hand that feeds me here because I want to read this. The caller, the listener writes, how enlightened are universities in regard to agriculture policies? Their research is largely financed by chemical and seed companies. At the same time, American universities train students from all over the world and have great influence worldwide. Is there any indication that our universities realize the damage they may be causing?
Mm. Great question. There's a fabulous book that kind of explores this concern called University Inc. I don't know if that listener is familiar with the book, but if you want to learn more about the connection, increasing connection between industries, all kinds of industries who are kind of funding research, really directing what research happens at universities, then University Inc. is the place to go. And I think it's a concern that many of us have about to what extent is the kind of the independent public interest ethic of universities being compromised by the money that's coming in from companies to direct what kind of research gets done, what kind of results we hear or don't hear. And that is a really big concern from the farmers that I've met and from the kind of food activists who I work with.
Yeah. There's one other thing that when we were actually chatting a little bit about this before we got going, and again, I'll invoke your mom one more time. What I think is really striking, if you look at some of the things that she wrote about, this was before you were born, in Diet for a Small Planet, which is coming up on the 40th anniversary, that a lot of that seemed kind of radical mm-hmm. at the time. But now, if you look at how people are starting to think about their food and that the fact that they're doing, again, that people are already doing, I think, some of the things, you know, just the fact that people now go down to the farmer's market mm-hmm. who are interested in organic produce, would like to shake hands with the person that grew their food. They're thinking about where the food came from and you know, how it managed to land on their plate. That's not radical anymore. That's getting to be more and more of mainstream kind of effort that a lot of more people are starting to think about. And to me, it makes me think about how, you know, if we could go another generation, we're talking about your kids, how people that, you know, at that point would be thinking about food and what they eat and how what sort of additional change we might see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, some of what we've focused on in this time together has been kind of on the negative side of the story about what we've seen happen in these 30 years, which hasn't been positive. On the other hand, what we've seen is just since the early 70s, when my mother was writing her first book, there was only a few hundred farmers markets in this country. The USDA just released the latest statistics on how many farmers markets we have. It's more than 6,200, double what we had 10 years ago. The whole phenomenon of community-supported agriculture where individuals can become shareholders in a farm and invest in a farm and really kind of share in whatever the bounty is from the farm. Those started in 1986. That whole concept started in 1986. There are now thousands of CSA farms. In New York City alone, there are more than 75. I am a part of a CSA. 222 families in my one neighborhood are part of a CSA supporting a farm in Long Island. And the whole movement that's happening across the country, especially that's coming out of colleges and schools, of young people saying they want to see the food system move in a different direction. This weekend, there is, just in a few days, there is the first ever nationwide youth summit on food justice on college campuses that's being convened in regions across the country by the Real Food Challenge, 1,000 students in Boston, 600 students in the Southeast, 300 students in California, 300 students in the Southwest, students all across the country who are working to change the food on college campuses. That kind of energy, that kind of activism is really exciting for me to see.
We're going to have to leave it at that. If you don't want to read more of our guest's thinking on this, you take a look at her recent book, Diet for a Hot Planet. Bloomsbury is the publisher. Our guest, Anna Lappe. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.